Hello, and welcome to our program, Senior Living, brought to you by OWL Radio and the Low Vision Resource Center. I'm Chrissy Mernon. During this next half hour, I'm reading articles from AARP, the magazine, here on OWL Radio. And this is from their Healthy You section, 8 Habits That Are Raising Your Blood Pressure. Seemingly innocent everyday behaviors might be putting you at risk for stroke. Hypertension is commonly called the silent killer. It's a leading risk factor for stroke, heart attack, and heart failure. But while exercise, medication, and going easy on the salt shaker are all important in keeping blood pressure down, you may be undoing all that good with a handful of personal habits that can put you at increased risk. Ask yourself if any of these factors sound like you. Pressure point number one. You're an antisocial woman or an overly social man. As a species, we're not meant to be without other people, says Anna Lynn Conklin, an assistant professor at the University of British Columbia. If you are socially isolated, it raises your cortisol levels to put you in a fight or flight response. A study Conklin conducted of 28,238 adults ages 45 to 85 found that for women, being single, having limited social activity, or being part of a small social network was linked to higher average blood pressure. Interestingly, Conklin's study found that men who lived alone or had small social networks were less likely to have high blood pressure than those who lived with others or had large networks greater than 220 people. It's unclear whether the difference was due to biological reasons or simply because there's less stigma around men going it alone. That said, feeling isolated is not good for your arteries. Another smaller study of adults ages 50 to 68 found that those with the highest scores on a loneliness survey had a systolic blood pressure, the first number in a blood pressure reading, that was 10 to 30 points higher than that of their less lonely counterparts. Pressure point number two, you hold it when you have to go. A full bladder raises blood pressure about 10 to 15 points, explains Luke Laffin, MD, co-director of the Center for Blood Pressure Disorders at the Cleveland Clinic. That's why he and his colleagues encourage people to urinate before they measure their blood pressure, particularly if they're doing so to monitor the medications they're taking at home. It's fine to hold it if you're in a situation where you cannot urinate freely, but if you can use the restroom, then you shouldn't necessarily delay, Laffin says. Do a preemptive pee before going to the theater or beginning a long car ride. Speaking of urination, getting up frequently at night to relieve yourself may be a sign of hypertension. If your blood pressure is elevated, that causes the body to say, "I need to lower my blood pressure." One way to do that is to urinate, Laffin notes. Pressure point number three, you haven't had your thyroid checked in a while. Both overactive and underactive thyroids can raise blood pressure. A severely overactive thyroid can boost your risk of cardiovascular issues, says Nicola Rhonda Bloom, MD, an accredited endocrinologist based in New Hyde Park, New York. Bloom encourages patients to get their levels checked annually or every 6 months if they have a strong family history of thyroid disease or symptoms. And if you're on thyroid medication, make sure you're taking it as prescribed. Skipping medicine for low thyroid doesn't often cause high blood pressure, but missing medicine for high thyroid can be problematic, Bloom adds. Pressure point number four, you pass on the produce. Having too much sodium is a long-established catalyst for hypertension, but consuming a diet rich in produce can help counter these effects thanks to the potassium found in many fruits and vegetables. Potassium decreases blood pressure by causing our bodies to release sodium, says Seamus Welton, MD, an assistant professor of medicine at the Johns Hopkins Medicine Division of Cardiology. Men should aim for 3,400 milligrams of potassium per day, and women need about 2,600. There's no need to take potassium supplements unless your doctor recommends this. Foods including bananas, dried fruit, potatoes, and beans will help keep your salt-to-potassium ratio in check. About 75% of the sodium most people consume is already in food when they buy it, Welton says. Swapping out processed foods and eating 4 to 5 servings of fruits and 4 to 5 servings of vegetables per day is the key to reducing your sodium and upping your potassium. pressure point number 5. You relax with a drink or two. A study of more than 17,000 U.S. adults found that just 7 to 13 drinks per week substantially raises one's risk of high blood pressure. Moderate drinkers were 53% more likely to have stage 1 hypertension and twice as likely to have stage 2 hypertension than participants who didn't drink. That percentage got higher with the more drinks a person had. Welton warns that even drinking too much in one sitting can spike your blood pressure over the next few days. Stick to the rule of thumb of 1 to 2 drinks per day for men and 1 per day for women. Pressure point number 6. You take medication your cardiologist doesn't know about. In one study, 18.5% of adults with hypertension reported taking a medication that contributed to increased blood pressure. There are several medications that can do it, notes Carrie Kimmelstale, MD, director of the Interventional Cardiology Center at Tufts Medical Center and a professor of medicine at the Tufts University School of Medicine. Non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, NSAIDs, such as naproxen, Aleve, and ibuprofen, Motrin, and decongestants like Sudafed, which contains pseudoephedrine, are known to increase high blood pressure. Some antidepressants and immunosuppressants can also be culprits. Always ask your cardiologist about new medications before taking them, he says. Pressure point number 7. You have erratic bedtimes. People who don't get 6 to 8 hours of uninterrupted sleep can have elevated blood pressure, Laffin says. Several studies have found that sleepless nights raise blood pressure not only throughout the night, but the next day as well. For quality sleep, go to bed and wake up at the same time every day, avoiding drinking and eating 90 minutes before bed, and don't watch television in bed. And if you're snoring, gasping for air in the night, or exceptionally tired during the day, get checked for sleep apnea. Treating this lowers blood pressure by 3 or 4 points in the average individual, Laffin adds. Pressure point number 8. You're toughing it out with chronic pain. Ongoing pain issues can cause chronically elevated blood pressure, according to Laffin, and taking NSAIDs for more than a week to try to manage your pain can raise your risk even more. If you have pain that lasts for more than a few weeks, see your physician and don't delay needed operations such as knee or hip replacements. Treat the underlying cause of the pain and then the blood pressure elevation goes away, Laffin says. The next article from the AARP magazine. Want to be a better grandparent? Sign up for a class today, seriously. The first time I held my granddaughter, I was awash in love. Then my mind drifted in a less wholesome direction. Could I spirit her away under my coat? In my backpack? In my carry-on luggage? I'm kidding. Sort of. Soon enough, though, tiny Annie got hungry and began rooting around my chest, becoming increasingly frantic. Oh, honey, that restaurant has been closed for decades, I told her, feeling forlorn. My daughter scooped up the baby and began to nurse her. Annie may have felt like my baby. I may have wanted her to be my baby. But nature had bluntly reminded me that those days were over. I was grandma now, and baby lust aside, I was so glad I had invested in some attitude adjustment. As in, a grandparenting class. Literally, I am a proud graduate of a 2-hour virtual grandparenting class given through the Perinatal Education Program at Lucile Packard Children's Hospital, Stanford, in California. Classes for new grandparents are popping up around the country, many of them virtual in the wake of the pandemic. These hospital-based classes seem to share the same origin. New parents in baby groups begged instructors to educate grandparents. We were hearing from the young mothers, says Stanford's Nancy Sanchez. We realized that getting everyone on the same page would definitely help that transition. The reality is that standards of baby care have changed since you raised children, and you need to learn to navigate a new relationship with the parents. Highlights. Number 1, child safety is paramount. When I had babies in the 80s, we put them in cribs on their stomach, advised that this would prevent infants from choking on their own spit up. Later research reversed that thinking. Babies who sleep on their tummies are at a higher risk for sudden infant death syndrome, SIDS. Speaking of the crib, no more bumpers, blankets, or toys. Also smothering risk allowed in there, just a bottom sheet. If you want to up your life-saving skills, take an infant CPR course and learn how to install new car seats. Number two, respect your kids. Try to remember, it's not your child. Repeat, it's not your child. Unless you believe your grandchild is in real danger, keep your mouth shut. Three, live and learn as you go. A few days after my graduation, my husband and I were on our way across the country to meet our new granddaughter. The 3 weeks of helping my daughter and son-in-law with the baby went remarkably smoothly, in no small part due to what I had learned in class. Despite my instincts to steal that baby, I focused on taking care of the parents. I did a lot of cooking. My husband did many loads of laundry. It seemed like we were at the grocery store every day. The bleary-eyed new parents were incredibly grateful. I slipped up twice. Once when my son-in-law took the baby outside on a chilly day without wrapping her up. I think I get a pass for chasing after him with a blanket. Less so when I chided my daughter for waking up Annie to feed her. Of course I was wrong. New research says feeding every 1 to 3 hours is the best practice, no matter what. But those tiny hiccups were swamped by the joy of snuggling my granddaughter almost to my heart's content. And thanks to a little formal preparation, I'm welcome back for more. If you dream of retiring abroad, test the waters first. Roughly 100,000 Americans moved overseas in 2021, and countless 60-somethings are pondering or fantasizing about doing the same after retirement. But it's not easy, and it's not cheap. If you are even remotely considering such a move, test out the location first. Here's how, according to Tim Liffel, author of A Better Life for Half the Price. Before you go, nab a short-term visa. Most countries offer 3-month tourist visas. Double-check the rules on the destination's government website. Check your travel and health insurance. If your trip will span months, you may need to upgrade to a plan that covers your whole time away. Read local news. Get an online or mail subscription to a local newspaper, magazine, or newsletter to learn about key players, issues, and crime on a hyper-local level. Once there, live like a local. Run errands, get a haircut, buy groceries. As you do, work out whether you're happy with the services and the cost. Really walk the neighborhood and get a feel for which areas feel comfortable and which don't, says Liffel. Sample the language. Research nearby language schools and enroll in a short-term program. You'll quickly grasp whether you enjoy learning it, and your classmates are likely to be fellow expats. The next article from AARP, the magazine, is Cash, a Modern User's Guide. Here's everything you need to know about the legal tender in your wallet, the savings in your accounts, the digital payments at the checkout counter, and the old coins in your drawer. Learn how to fend off inflation's sting, protect yourself from a cash crunch, go electronic with your money, and maybe even hit the jackpot. Part 1. The number to shoot for. Ready Cash, dollars you can quickly pull from a checking, savings, or money market account, is key to financial security and a good night's sleep. Here's how much of it you need, by Lynn Asenoff. Cash on hand. You need it for daily cups of coffee, weekend grocery runs, and monthly utility bills. You need it for major outlays like a new car or a home remake. And you need it for emergencies, repairs, medical bills, natural disasters, and more. But how much cash? That's the tough question. Not enough in your wallet or in the bank, and every curve life throws you becomes a financial crisis that could force you to take on new debt or cash out investments at a loss. Too much set aside, and you risk lost opportunities. Family vacations never taken, long-term investments never made. The right amount of cash on hand is one of my clients' most common concerns, says Stephen Thalheimer, a financial planner in Silver Spring, Maryland. The number depends on many factors, including your income, family needs, life goals, and whether you're retired, plus your worries if they're keeping you up at night. It's a very individual thing, Thalheimer says. Not sure about the liquid assets you need? You can get a good idea by making a few simple estimates outlined in these steps. Step 1. Tally monthly expenses. Total up all your outlays, whether they're household supplies, dinners out, or utility bills. You'll find the numbers you need by looking at recent credit card bills, bank statements, and pay stubs. Go long. The more months you look out, the less likely you will be to overlook mandatory expenditures that aren't monthly, like insurance premiums, tax payments, and oil changes. The bigger the time period, the better the data, says Kristen Pugh, a private wealth manager at Creative Planning in Atlanta. The result is the amount of money you realistically need per month, on average, when things are going well. Step 2. Subtract what's optional. The goal here is to plan for an interruption in your income, or what's known as a supply emergency. In contrast, a demand emergency is a large unexpected expense. More on this later. If you're in the workforce in your 60s, losing your job is an all-too-common supply emergency. One possible solution is for you to start taking Social Security. But that's not always the best option. You may not be ready to retire, and the longer you delay claiming benefits on your own record up to age 70, the larger your monthly check for the rest of your life. So, to plan for a supply emergency without tapping Social Security, you need to know how much money you would really need to get by each month. To do that, return to your list of expenses and divide them into those that are essential, say rent, food, medicine, and those that are not, streaming services, hobby costs, various memberships. Making that distinction is a very personal process. In your 60s, traveling to see grandchildren may be the priority, or staying fit via a health club membership. Some people say Netflix is pretty essential, says Dana Levitt of Paragon Financial Advisors in Newton, Massachusetts. What's important is that you're honest with yourself. Once you tally what's cuttable, subtract that number from your current monthly spending. The result is your monthly number for getting by. Step 3. Decide how many months you'll cover. Once you know your base level monthly cash needs during a supply emergency, consider how many months you think it would take to get your income going again. For years, financial planners have generally recommended having enough cash to cover 3 to 6 months worth of expenses. Rules of thumb are a good starting point, but each situation is going to be different, says Judith Ward, a senior financial planner at T. Rowe Price. While there is no universal formula, keeping a minimum of 3 months of living expenses on hand is a good starting point. As of last December, about 2/3 of America's unemployed population had been out of work for up to 14 weeks, a number that has stayed relatively constant over the past year. If you are disabled, it can take at least 3 months before you can begin to collect disability insurance. Social Security disability insurance can take 5 months or more after you are disabled to kick in. Consider these other factors when thinking about a supply-side emergency. Job stability. How secure does your employment feel? A physician's assistant, the profession ranked as the most stable in a recent U.S. News & World Report jobs analysis, will likely need a smaller emergency stash than a salesperson for a tech startup who's paid mostly via commissions. Someone who works for a seasonal business needs extra reserves to cover months of limited work. Employment type. Should you lose a job, the time it will take to find a new one depends on your industry and your particular position. A 2017 study by the job site Glassdoor, for example, found that the average interview process for software developers and regional sales managers lasted about 40 days. For delivery drivers and retail salespeople, it was a little more than a week. Age. In your 60s, a job search will take longer. Nearly 40% of unemployed adults ages 55 to 64 were unemployed for 15 or more weeks in a recent jobs report. The average length of unemployment for job seekers in that age group was 33 weeks, compared with 26 weeks for workers 45 to 54. Income streams. If you are the sole earner in the household, you might want more months of savings on hand, maybe even 9 to 12, says Levitt. But if you're in a two-income household in two very different industries, you may feel comfortable with less, believing that one salary could cover a good portion of your expenses should you lose the other. Dependents. If the household is just you and a partner, or you alone, it may feel easy to cut back. But if you're raising children or grandchildren, many expenses, their food and education for starters, are harder to reduce. Similarly, If you're supporting an adult unable to care for him or herself, cutting back on health care and caregiving may not feel like an option. Whatever number of months you decide on, multiply that figure by the amount of money you need per month to get by during a supply emergency. That's how much money you need to be safe. And step four, budget for surprises. Now let's consider demand emergencies, a broken major appliance, for example, or a trip to the ER. These can pop up whether you are still working or already retired and on a fixed income. If you have enough money in the bank to cover a few months of lost income, you probably have enough to cover a sudden expense as well. A 2020 academic paper written in collaboration with AARP found that having $2,500 in a bank account correlated with a lower chance of financial distress years later. Bottom line, it's up to you whether you want to add extra money to your safety cushion from step three to cover potential surprises, but if a big expense comes along, you'll want to replenish the amount you took from your reserve and bring it back to a safe level. Step five, prepare for future needs. An expense that's out of the ordinary isn't necessarily unpredictable. Perhaps you would like to take a vacation or buy a new car, or maybe you'll be financing a wedding someday soon. Things will go more smoothly if you start putting money away, separate from your emergency fund, so that when the time comes, you don't have to borrow at short notice or sell investments when markets are down. Think of these funds as separate from an emergency fund, a liquidity bucket, in the words of Anthea Perkinson, who operates Monterey Associates, a financial planning firm in Pelham, New York. Your goal with such funds is to make sure that money is available when you need it. Finally, don't despair if having even 3 months' worth of living expenses on hand feels impossible. Only about 4 in every 10 Americans have enough savings to cover an unplanned expense of $1,000, according to a survey by Bankrate. You can build up your cash reserve bit by bit. Start small, and remember that every dollar saved can cover some kind of emergency, says Pugh of Creative Planning. She cites a woman she was advising who had managed to set aside just $100 in her emergency fund. When the battery in that woman's car died, that $100 in the bank was most welcome. Part 3. Good reasons to change how you pay. Freebies, security, and convenience are just some of the benefits of favoring credit cards and digital payments over cash and checks. COVID has reduced older Americans' comfort with handling cash, but we still can't quite let go of the habit. A sign of the times. In 2019, adults in two different age groups, those ages 18 to 24 and those 55 to 64, used cash for about one-third of their purchases, according to Federal Reserve research. 2 years later, that older cohort was still using cash 26% of the time. For young adults, however, the figure had dropped to only 17%. And while 59% of young adults said they would be comfortable leaving their cash at home and instead paying with their smartphone, only 36% of Americans ages 51 to 65 would sign on to that, according to research from the payments firm Marqeta. The most common reason older adults gave for carrying cash? Force of habit. If you're one of those people who find it hard to kick that cash habit, consider these benefits of going from paper to plastic or electronic when making purchases or dining out. Rewards. Many credit cards come with rewards programs that earn you points or as much as 5% cash back on all your purchases, whether you use the card in person, online, or through a smartphone app known as a digital wallet, Apple Pay and Google Wallet, for example. Points can be redeemed for things like flights, hotel stays, and statement credits. Rewards are basically free money, says Ted Rossman, a senior credit card analyst for Bankrate.com. There is, however, an important caveat. These rewards won't nearly cover the interest cost if you're carrying a credit card balance from month to month. Don't spend more than you have in your checking account, Rossman says. Pay the balance in full each month and avoid interest. Security. Worried that electronic payments are risky? Actually, it's quite the opposite. All the popular e-payment tools come with multiple features that combat fraud and diminish the risk of making mistakes. For instance, Credit cards and digital wallets use encrypted data, which essentially means your credit card number and information are not transmitted, says Tara Alderete, a certified financial educator with Money Management International. This makes it difficult for anyone to steal your card number. And if a thief does somehow gain access to your card, the transaction may be stopped by your card issuer's fraud detection system. If all else fails, you're typically not on the hook for unauthorized purchases as long as you promptly report them to your card issuer. Note that credit card protections are greater than those for debit cards, and it's essential to never share your debit card PIN with anyone. As for dropping a check in the mail to pay your utility bill, there's been a rise in mailbox theft in recent years, which may make paying bills by credit card or electronic transfer a safer choice. Interestingly, an earlier pre-pandemic study from the Federal Reserve found that 25% of adults ages 65 and older preferred paying bills with checks, compared to only 7% of adults ages 18 to 44. Credit. Older people tend to have the highest credit scores, but if you paid off all your loans long ago and seldom use a credit card, you could eventually become what's known as unscorable. Not having an up-to-date credit score could make it harder to qualify for a loan, get insurance, set up a utility account, or get a cell phone plan, says John Alzheimer, a credit expert who formerly worked with FICO and Equifax. It's important that you use credit from time to time so your credit reports never start collecting dust, he says. If you're worried about paying interest or going into debt, Alzheimer says use credit cards only for small everyday purchases and pay off the balance in full each month. Convenience. Once you get used to digital payment tools, they're easy and fast to use. At the register, electronic transactions take just seconds, and you won't have to fumble through your pockets for loose change. Among friends and family, peer-to-peer payment apps make it simple for you to send and receive money from your smartphone or other device. With P2P apps like Venmo, Zelle, and Cash App, you can quickly and easily split a dinner bill, repay a friend for the concert ticket she bought you, tip a service worker, or send money to a relative. Part 4. Are my old coins worth a small fortune? A lesson in valuing the change in your junk drawer. How do you get a fair price for old coins when you don't know what they're worth? That was the question my father-in-law, Howard, and I faced last summer. He had a pile of change inherited decades ago, a 50-cent piece from 1826, a penny minted during the Civil War, a silver dollar from 1885, and six more from the 1920s. I had a $2 bill from the 1950s and some pristine John F. Kennedy half dollars from 1964, the last year the U.S. minted silver coins for circulation. It all seemed like a potentially valuable stash, and we were both ready to sell. But we were also ignorant about coin collecting, so I volunteered to take the lead and talk to a range of coin experts, numismatists, to use a fancy word, to get their advice about valuing currency and selling it. Fantasies of Antiques Roadshow began swimming in my head. Those thrilling moments when someone says, "That little old thing you brought in, it's worth $1 jillion. Here's what I learned on my quest for knowledge and riches. Lesson 1. Most things are common. That sobering bit of wisdom came from Mitch Sanders, a columnist for the magazine of the American Numismatic Association. You know what's common? My lovely 1964 Kennedy half dollars. The mints made them in the millions. 2. Common things can have some extra value, like other 20th century half dollars, dimes, and quarters minted before 1965. My half dollars are 90% silver. Lesson 3. Oldies aren't necessarily goodies. I had high hopes for Howard's 1920 silver dollars. They were 100 years old, no wear, no tear. Silver value about $15 alone. Sadly, I learned I might get only $25 or $30 a piece for them. Why? Millions more of these coins were minted than people needed. Lesson 4. Condition can count a lot. Lesson 5. Ultimately, value lies in rarity. You have been listening to Senior Living on Al Radio. You can listen to Al Radio on our specially tuned radio or by streaming on your computer or smartphone. You may also listen at your convenience on our podcast page at www.alradio.org. Thank you for listening. This program will be replayed after 9 this evening. I'm Chrissy Mernon, saying goodbye from Al Radio.